524-0679, People versus Strickland. Arguing for the appellant is Yasmin Navi. Arguing for the appellee is Max Boos. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note, only the clerk of the court is permitted to record these proceedings today.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Boos, you're double duty today, huh?
Yes, good morning. Lucky me.
All right. Is it Navi? Is that how
Navai,
you?
Navai,
Navi.
Navai,
All right,
Navai
Ms.
with a Y.
Navi. Okay. You represent the appellant in this case?
I do, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you very much. Your Honors, this case represents a tripart ineffective assistance of counsel claim that is fully spread of record. It relates to the recorded interrogation video of Mr. Strickland. A redacted copy was introduced to Mr. Strickland's jury. It contained numerous problematic information within it. Beyond repeated admissions to touching the complainant's sex organs, it included an admission by him that he was not acting accidentally. And not surprisingly, the prosecutor capitalized on that in closing arguments. As defeating his defense. It also contained a lot of irrelevant material that was unrelated to the incident but highly prejudicial. Finally, it contained improperly admitted opinion statements by the officers regarding the complainant's credibility and his propensity. The two of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims relate to a failure to file a suppression motion. The state, in large measure, does not contest the merits of that motion. What it does reply to is say that the argument that that counsel made a strategic decision to introduce that redacted ERI in lieu of presenting his testimony. That brings us to the third ineffective assistance of counsel claim that I'd like to focus my time on today, because that one assumes the admissibility, even the desirability, of introducing a statement and yet contests counsel's representation. At a post-trial hearing, counsel explained that he did not believe his client could withstand examination by the prosecutor and wanted to present a redacted ERI to present his client's accident theory to the jury in his own words. That was unsound strategy. However, I'll leave it to my briefs on that unless you have other questions. Even if this court finds that that was a sound strategy, this court should find counsel ineffective because he failed to seek additional redactions of improper material. He failed to request a limiting instruction that would have contextualized the officer's improperly admitted opinion statements, and the prosecutor was allowed to compound the error during Sergeant Nyman's direct examination, essentially present Sergeant Nyman as the human lie detector that he claimed to be in the video statements. I'm going to discuss each in turn. First, with respect to the redactions, prior to trial, counsel filed a motion which identified some statements which were problematic, but that only related to the first hour and a half of the interrogation video. It did not discuss Sergeant Nyman's at all, Sergeant Nyman's interrogation at all, and did not seek exclusion of various information, allegations of other crimes evidence, dysfunctional family life. It also did not seek to exclude anything about Mr. Strickland's past victimization as a child sex victim, which the interrogators discussed at length. And as I said, they espoused their opinions as to him having a propensity based upon that revelation. That is objectively unsound. But that brings me to my next point, the limiting instruction. Counsel, at the very least, even if you wanted to introduce the minimization techniques or such to explain why Adam confessed, he should have included within that a limiting instruction, which would have advised the jury that this was not truthful, not necessarily truthful, not substantive evidence. Without it, the jury was left to consider the officer's opinions as to OS's credibility, Adam's incredibility at their statements that he likely had other victims, and finally, most problematically, that he had the statistical likelihood of committing these crimes, and that there was other evidence out there that supported OS's credibility. Rather than take any of these measures, counsel exacerbated the error during the examination of Nyman. In that, Officer Nyman testified that he lied to Adam when he said OS had passed that test, that question on her test. But then whatever benefit came from that recognition was immediately undid when he said he did that in order to establish OS's credibility. He also testified that he told Adam about his training in order to show Adam his ability to detect deceit. So, in effect, the prosecutor was allowed to present without going through Illinois rules of evidence and tendering him as an expert, as an expert. That was highly damaging in a close case. And this brings me to the prejudice prong. And this also touches on why failure to file a motion to suppress was objectively unsound as well. The state diminishes the devastating impact of this statement. It included admissions not just to one or two, but repeated admissions to touching OS's breast, buttocks, vagina, the lips of her vagina, and inserting his finger in her vagina. And then on top of that, his admission that he acted not accidentally. That went against the defense at trial, according to the def and not surprisingly, the jury asked to see the portions of that video, and the prosecutor played it for it. In addition, the defense didn't need either Adam's trial testimony or the interrogation video. There was plenty of evidence that this was an accidental touching. OS, by her own admission, claimed all of the incidents happened while the horseplay, where an accidental touching is entirely likely, happened very quickly while people were around. And indeed, there was clear evidence that she may have been groomed or at least carried on an inappropriate relationship with another individual, which may have caused her to misconstrue an accidental touching as something far more nefarious. So, for all of those reasons, this court should find trial counsel ineffective. I see I have a little more time. I anticipate the state is going to argue about forfeiture and the standard of review. I'll touch upon that as well. Neither is a basis for this court to refuse to address this fully developed ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which the state does not dispute as spread of record. Veach is controlling Illinois Supreme Court precedent, and it holds that if it is fully developed, a court of the, an appellate court can review it. None of the cases that the state cites holds that a defendant is required to litigate or even raise at a pro se Krenkel motion all of his ineffective assistance of counsel claims in order to avoid forfeiture. In fact, the Krenkel procedure is developed to protect defendants, not to hurt them. Finding forfeiture would hurt and would undermine the very purpose of Krenkel. None of the state's cases hold that. As to the standard of review, the Supreme Court cases upon which the state principally relies, Jackson and Patrick, are dealt with preliminary Krenkel inquiries and don't support their position that that the manifest error standard applies to a third stage, to a standalone ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which it must be remembered that only two of those were litigated at the post-trial hearing. One of them is based upon the record, but there's no findings of facts to defer to. So a manifest error would be particularly inappropriate. The bifurcated standard, which Adam advocated for in his opening brief and which has been endorsed by the Illinois Supreme Court, is the proper standard of review to apply, Your Honors. And for that, for all of those reasons, for our briefs, the motion to cite additional authority, which just provides more evidence as to why The particularly the third ineffective assistance of counsel claims require reversal. However way you look at it, he received an unfair trial and needs a new trial. Thank you very much. If there are no questions, I will just wait for a rebuttal then.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
Can you have harmless error in this case?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
It's important to note that the Illinois Supreme Court and RC has recognized that a videotaped statement is one of the most damaging. In this case, we have extremely damaging revelations. We have repeated admissions. We have an admission to him saying that this was not accidental. That, of course, was replayed by the jury, by the prosecutor to the jury during closing arguments. That's proof positive that that the admission of this statement was very damaging. I can't stress that enough. If that was the theory, they destroyed it. And there was, while there is some evidence to support the verdict in this case, that is not the test for whether there was prejudice under Strickland. Davila, which the state never addressed in their brief, sets that out very nicely. The fact that there is evidence doesn't mean to support a verdict doesn't mean that he didn't receive a fair trial, especially where the prosecutor was able to backdoor improperly admitted expert testimony in essence. I mean, the fact that they, propensity to commit these crimes, they repeatedly discussed his sexual abuse as a child and suggested that that made him more likely guilty than not. It's hard to see how this could be harmless in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Justice Hackett, questions?
Not at this time, thank you.
Justice Barberis?
No, thanks.
Okay. All right. Mr. Booth, I will. Mr. Booth, you made a reference in your brief that the defendant had violated Illinois Supreme Court Rule 341 and that the facts were slanted and did not properly cite to the record. I don't want to ask you a question about that, but as the presiding justice of our court, I did not find that your argument was well taken. And just so you know, I don't think it's necessary to recite facts in your brief that are well cited by the defendant. I don't like to read all those pages. So in the Fifth District, we try not to duplicate the fact section if possible. So I mention that to you so that you can spread the word. That said, Mr. Bruce, for the state, you're allowed to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. To begin with, since defendant asserts that the evidence showed all contact was accidental or supported that finding, I'd just like to read from some of the victim's testimony where she stated defendant would, quote, get on top of me and put his hand in my pants, unquote, and insert his finger into her vagina three or four times, that he repeatedly molested her, and that he, quote, pushed me up and down against his private part, end quote. Just to resolve any questions about whether the evidence was ambiguous or squirrely. However, as to the claims in this case, in preparing a defense, counsel was faced with defendant's recorded admissions to vaginal contact while claiming it was accidental. The victim was credible with an early ignored outcry and consistent corroborating descriptions of the underlying locations and events, including graphic, inappropriate sexual contact. Trial counsel developed two defenses. First, that defendant's pre-existing claim of accidental and misunderstood contact, and second, her acquittal from the jury's sympathy for defendant and rejection of the police questioning. That strategy was reasonable, and defendant does not establish prejudice in light of the evidence. The people will review the standard established by the Illinois Supreme Court and focus on defendant's demonstrated capacity to waive his Miranda rights, that is, what was not overborne, and his statements were voluntary, and defendant's inability to establish prejudice, the futility of argument on limiting instructions or redactions, and lastly, his arguments analogizing expert testimony. To begin with, for the manifest error standard of review, after receiving a ruling on the merits of an ineffective assistance claim, defendant cannot pretend his Krankel hearing never happened. He may not ignore this in the course of review and ruling on the live evidence, nor may he make that a waste of judicial resources through this appeal. That is, as to the claims that he actually presented, the court reviewed the evidence, and the standard is he must establish manifest error where he has received a ruling on the merits. That apply, counsel suggests that because that relates or focuses on Krankel inquiry stage, where the court makes a ruling on the merits, that applies doubly after a consideration of live testimony to suggest that the standard of review is less deferential after the court does the work of reviewing the evidence submitted by the parties and additional factual matters that only the trial court is in the best position to review. This court should reject that proposed standard. Now, as to the ineffective assistance claim itself, trial counsel demonstrably considered and developed a strategy as to the police interview in this case. Given its utility for impeachment, defendant was locked into a story that the contact was real but accidental, and his denials allowed defendant to rebut the victim without taking the stand. Defendant faced the victim's initial outcry years before any later statements that was ultimately ignored or rejected by the family. There was a social worker, two CAC employees who all provided evidence of the victim's statements and descriptions, as well as the victim's testimony, as well as her mother and father corroborating the factual events and her father expressing that it was a serious situation and her persisting in her claims nonetheless. Defendant has not established that no reasonable attorney would agree with the strategy of rebutting the basis for the bad parts of his interview while presenting the good parts of his interview, the denials, in the controlled area of a recording where he was not subject to cross-examination, particularly after insisting that he did not fare well under questioning. Counsel and defendant agreed, alongside defendant's wife, that he was not a good candidate for cross-examination, that that was not a good avenue for him to go down. And so counsel developed a reasonable strategy to avoid that. It wasn't perfect, but that's what counsel was left with. He either needed to allow the statements by the victim to go uncontradicted by his own statements, or to take the stand, or to use the video. He elected to use the video. The part of why that was reasonable is because the waiver was intelligent, and so suppression was not warranted. Defendant's sidelong statement that it was harder for him to do stuff because of an eye issue was completely undermined by his denial that there was any kind of general effect that he had to deal with, or any kind of issues with his general operation, as stated in the interview and throughout the pendency of the case, including in the PSI, where he denies having any kind of mental disability. His desire to manufacture one on appeal is undermined by his own statements in the trial court level. Moreover, he has not developed a record to establish he has any such kind of intellectual cognitive disability, as he suggests on appeal. I believe that was the statement used by defendant. He also engaged candidly and complexly with the interview and with his Krankel testimony. He established he knew what was going on. He knew how to handle himself. He even, during his Krankel testimony, distinguished a Krankel inquiry with a Krankel hearing, demonstrating his ability to parse legal concepts as contradicting his claim that he is generally unable to. In addition, defendant's statements were voluntary. His power of resistance was demonstrated by consistently asserting that the contact was accidental. That was raised early, repeatedly throughout his interview, and stated as, in fact, the last factual statement that he gave to Detective Sergeant Nyman was him stating that any contact was accidental. Any other undermining statements that he made was swiftly followed by his insistence that contact was accidental. So defense counsel had to evaluate how to handle the statements in the video. The limiting instructions or redactions that defendant suggests be done to the questioning would not remove defendant's harmful statements. That is still a problem in this case for defense counsel to evaluate. And so defense counsel determined that he would undermine those statements by the police. How? By asserting that the police were liars and that they overstated their position, that they didn't know what they were talking about. That is demonstrated by counsel's questioning of Detective Sergeant Nyman. Detective Hawthorne had already established that personality traits of the defendant were part of how the interview was conducted, but it was Detective Sergeant Nyman that undermined any suggestion that the jury should accept his factual averments in the interview as true. He stated that he made falsehoods during the interview and provided examples, including his assessment of the victim. He undermined the factual underpinnings of his statements in the interview. This is not defendant, pardon me. This is not the detective sergeant taking the stand and telling the jury that defendant was grooming. This is the detective sergeant saying why he conducted the interview the way he did as a means of simple explanation for general questioning. But that does not, his attempts to gain credibility with the defendant is what a police officer does during an interview in order to elicit information and to gather the truth. That is an established basis for police interrogation. The questioning and the manner of it were explained as what he was trying to do, but it did not insist that the victim was necessarily correct, and it did not insist that he was necessarily correct himself. Again, he said that he lied during that interview. As such, the defense did not want to limit what the jury could use the police's statements for. They wanted to tell the jury that the officer's statement meant that defendant was forced to lie and that it should use them to acquit defendant entirely. Any limiting instruction would undermine that argument. In addition, further redactions.
You think that sometimes the argument is based upon the ruling of the trial court? That is, if the court rules that this is coming in, then the defense has to respond somehow by fashioning a defense around what they know is coming in.
Part of the deference for trial strategy decisions is for that very fact, that counsel has to adapt along the way. But counsel described in detail during the Krankel hearing what he was trying to do and why, that he wanted the jury inflamed against the police, that he wanted for the jury to use the denials. If I may have some time
Sure,
left, I'd
go
like.
ahead and finish the question.
Thank you. It's for that reason that the standard is permissive, that if a reasonable attorney could find that the strategy was appropriate, then even aside from prejudice, even aside from whether defendant would be adrift, unrebutting the victim's testimony and or facing cross-examination, even aside from those matters, that the defense counsel here demonstrated not just that he was responding to the rulings on his motions in limine, which did not fully encompass a motion to suppress, but in fact, his strategy was to utilize that interview instead of damaging cross-examination, instead of having his client testify. That was the basis for the strategy in this case.
All right. Justice Hackett, questions?
So then, in your views, the question really the extent of the use of a limiting instruction or a redaction. Some of what you say may be appropriate, but the remainder of the video statement may also arguably contain things that could have been redacted without advancing these points you wish to advance.
Part of the issues is that defendant made numerous statements, all indicating contact with the victim before any suggestion that the questioning was inflammatory, emotional, or misleading, other than stating that the defendant was a good guy who didn't want to harm children, which doesn't like rise to the level of coercion. As such, particularly given the nature of these arguments about certain redactions, certain limiting instructions, there are a lot of statements by defendant that are still getting at. And defense counsel had to determine how to respond to those statements and determined that one of the avenues was inflaming the jury against the police, insisting that the question was improper. And therefore, the questioning infected not only the answers around that, but any harmful statements. Counsel was trying to use the police questioning to get the jury to turn off when they hear bad things in the video based on the police questioning. That was the strategy.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bruce, what do you think about a police officer who says he has a certificate from the National Institute of Truth Verification, which trains individuals to become a human lie detector? Do you think that's appropriate and fair play for an officer?
Well, Your Honor, stating that he has some training in interrogation, even if a bit hyperbolized in that way, is not coercive, is the people's position. Because he can say that he has interviewed people before, he can say that he has some training in doing so, and the jury is allowed to evaluate whether or not that claim is a claim of mystical omniscience against lies, or whether it is him trying to develop credibility and elicit information from the, in this case, defendant.
Okay. Justice Hackett, any other questions?
No, thank you.
Justice Barberis.
I just have one, and it's not been touched on yet. There was some discussion in the briefs about this individual's disability. I didn't find how that was truly relevant to much of the proceedings. Just correct me if I'm wrong. From your perspective, did he basically acknowledged that he understood everything, that he wasn't having difficulties when he was being interrogated?
That is exactly his position at the time he is waiving his Miranda rights and being read those Miranda rights. He's saying, I have this eye issue. I'll let you know if he is told to let them know if it becomes a problem during questioning. He says he will. He says that it does not affect his general operation. And then through his statements elsewhere in the case, he denies having any kind of cognitive disability until it becomes helpful in undermining his conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bruce, in all fairness, he indicates he was not able to read the Miranda warning, correct?
He begins reading the Miranda warning within the interview. He begins reading the Miranda warning, and then the officer reads the rest of it aloud. Otherwhere in the record,
But
he
he
establishes.
reads the rest of it aloud because the defendant hands him the form, as I recall, and says he can't read it due to his disability.
I would need to review the video, Your Honor, but the video itself shows defendant being given the form. He begins reviewing the form. He is able to read a portion of it, but the remainder of it is all read to him by the officer, and then the officer verifies that he has understood the form before he ever signs it. If there is any indication to the officers that there's a problem, the officers cure that by making sure that he understands, by talking about his eye issue, by reviewing how it affects him, and encouraging him to let them know if it gets in the way of his questioning or is otherwise relevant.
But this is a defendant who was at odds with his own lawyer and needed his wife to explain what was going on. Isn't that the record?
What counsel described was that for specific legal concepts of criminal procedure, defendant would sometimes benefit from his wife explaining the matter after counsel tried to explain the matter for some period of time, and then his wife could help him understand it. That is for specific criminal procedure issues. It does not relate to the base Miranda concerns of you don't have to talk to me, you can have a lawyer. Those kinds of conversations. Defendant shows he can understand by his own statements during the interview and by his testimony during the Krankel hearing. He can get baseline Miranda right understanding, even if he is not as sophisticated as a lawyer, and even if explaining some of his confusion about how detailed criminal procedure works requires some effort.
All right, thank you. Justice Hackett, questions?
Clarification, the longer speaking about the record, I think my recollection was that the defendant's attorney indicated, I think it was at the Krankel testimony, in the Krankel testimony, that the motion to suppress in his judgment would have failed.
Yes.
I don't think the court found that, but the court did in its recitation indicated that some of the basics, such as the questioning of the voluntariness and the capability, he found the defendant capable and voluntarily acted. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I know that for the first point, yes, that is exactly what happened.
But
As
not the
to
second. That was just
the
the trial. That was just the attorney's testimony.
that the attorney testified to that, the circuit court specifically also found there was no reasonable probability the results would have been different, and that the attorney subjected the case to meaningful adversarial testing, as well as that the decision not to move to suppress was strategic and that there was no prejudice. It made specific findings on those different points.
But not specific as to elements of the voluntariness of the statement from the defendant,
I
correct?
believe it. I would defer to the order at C-255, but it did make a broad ruling as to the merits of the motion, I believe, or at minimum, counsel's evaluation of it.
Good enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Barberis.
Mother.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Booz. Ms. Nabai? I'm sorry. Rebuttal? You're on mute. Yep.
I'm
There
sorry
you go.
about that. I'm sorry
There you
about that.
go.
I have a number of clarifications to make. I am very familiar with this record. I have watched that video. Justice Cates, your recollection is pretty accurate. Let me go through first. Justice Barbaras, I want to answer your question. You had asked about the Miranda warnings and the cognitive disability and such. The record is very clear, and this goes to the state's point. The Miranda warnings, first of all, Mr. Strickland spoke at length about his disability. Beyond being an eye issue, in fact, it does affect his reading cognition. And there was great testimony about this from all three witnesses that his aniridia caused him to have difficulty reading, comprehending material that are read aloud. The Miranda warnings were only read to him once. I have reread this. I watched the video again, and I think it's fascinating. They were read to him in the very beginning by Detective Hawthorne. She tried, he read the first line. Adam had great difficulty, not surprisingly. And in less than 30 seconds, she went through the remaining Miranda rights quickly,
Okay, so
quickly.
let me stop you there. He has a responsibility to acknowledge if he has difficulty understanding it. She's not supposed to discern that from nothing. So
Okay.
if he acknowledged that he understood it and she was aware of his disability and questioned him with regard to, do you understand these rights? Do you have any questions? And he says no, what else is she supposed to do?
It's not, let me just correct you. It's not a matter of what she's supposed to do. Our question here is whether that Miranda waiver was valid in light of his disability. We're not critiquing her per se.
No, I
We're
and
saying,
I misspoke with that, but
yeah, I'm not trying to critique her. But to your point, he indeed intimated as much. He said the aniridia makes things harder for me to do, but neither of the officers followed up on that. But there is evidence out there that people with disabilities, in fact, have difficulties owning up to their limited knowledge. But getting back to the way the Miranda warnings were read, even if you just rule out the cognitive disability, in less than 30 seconds, the Miranda warnings were read to him. They were not repeated before he was given that very prejudicial CVSA test. The officer who handed that form, I watched this again and it's very clear. He refers to an unidentified form, which he says still applies. Then he hands defendant a second form, which he says this is kind of like a release, if you will. And he doesn't read over those rights. You're right, Adam doesn't request them to be read to him. But again, the question is not. What did Adam have to, what was he required to do? But whether we have evidence of a valid Miranda waiver, we just don't. And as to the voluntariness, I'll note, Your Honors, most of these states argue, first of all, let me back up. With the Miranda waiver, the state never disputes how the off in any of their briefs, they forfeited this, how the Miranda warnings, even when they were given, were like immediately erased by the use of coercive techniques, by the officers telling him that he wouldn't be hurt by confessing. There's case law and legal treatises and law reviews which show that these are extremely coercive techniques. I see my time is running, so I know my counsel had plenty of time extra. If you don't mind, I'd like to just touch on a few other points.
Sure, well, let me ask you a question quickly there, just kind of a basic
Yeah,
one.
I wanted to get to one of your questions actually. So,
Go ahead then, maybe you'll
just a
answer.
second. Yeah, it might be. To your point as to the trial court's ruling, the trial court never made a ruling of whether the motion to suppress would have been successful. And then indeed, the state doesn't largely dispute whether the merits of the motion. A lot of their arguments today, especially with regards to the limiting instruction, are entirely new. And I'm sorry, counsel, they have been forfeited. They have not been raised before. But the ruling, as to your honor, was limited to trial strategy and prejudice. Those are legal conclusions that are incorrect, and defendant has every right to challenge those and has challenged those properly in this standalone ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Then, but is that what you were getting at, Justice Hackett? I want to make sure I don't miss another question you had.
Partially, but I think you answered part of my next question. What you're not, my note was you're not challenging the factual determination of the trial court, but the legal determination as to trial strategy prejudice.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right, which is why de novo review is appropriate here, not manifest error. As to the reasonable trial strategy, as I said in my opening and in my briefs, throughout all of our briefs, and in this motion to cite additional authority, there is no, even if you find that trial counsel made a reasonable trial strategy decision to introduce the videotape statement, it is the height of ineffectiveness not to redact prejudicial information that did not result in any new information, but which paint him in a negative light. How does telling about his child sex abuse help him in any way, shape, or form, or referring to other victims, which he vehemently denies touching? It also begs the question, there must be a limiting instruction. Davila, Hardeman, there are cases out there. There are treatises from Jones, New York, on the law cited in this brief that say limiting instructions should be given. Otherwise, the jury is going to consider that substantively. That's extremely prejudicial. There is no trial strategy in this regard. As to Detective Nyman's statements, this is all new argument by the state in their in this. They have not answered this in their brief whatsoever. It is forfeited. However, Sergeant Nyman, as I indicated in my opening in my briefs, he only talked about lying as respect to OS's credibility. Importantly, he never said he was lying when he talked about the statistical likelihood that Adam would become a sex offender. That was out there as substantive evidence, absent a redaction or a limiting instruction. It's hard to say how, like, that is the height of prejudice in this case. And the
Okay,
fact,
I need to cut you off there, Miss Neff. I
yeah.
know that you're very you're
Thank
advocating for your client in a very, very positive way,
you.
but we have to cut you off in fairness. So, Justice Hackett, any other questions?
No, thank you.
Justice Barberis?
I have one question, and that's. Back in the fact section, said that OS had been suspended for drawing something at school. What exactly did she get suspended for drawing?
There were two suspensions. There was drawing of a, I think, a gun or a knife, something of that sort. And there was also a suspension for a man laying on top of a woman. There was those
Right, I knew
two.
that one, but the gun and the knife,
That was the last one, I believe. That was what caused these allegations.
What's the, and this is off topic at this point, I suppose, but what exactly is the infraction for drawing a picture of a gun or a knife that would result in a suspension?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Wasn't it wasn't that the picture depicted her using a gun or someone using a gun or a knife going after someone. It was just a picture of a gun or a knife, right?
Yes, that's the only indication we have. But
Okay.
it certainly brought the case to the attention of the social worker. And
Sure.
that's the context which it came out.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I
All
appreciate
right.
that.
Any other questions, Justice Hackett or Justice Barberis?
No,
No.
thank you.
All right. To both of you, I want to thank you for your arguments here today. We will take this matter under advisement and issue an order in due course. Have a great day.
Thank you. You as well. Happy
Thank
New
you,
Year.
Jonas. Have a good day.